Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the Bay Gourmet Forum. I'm Sally Fairfax, and I'm going to be the moderator for tonight's panel discussing what are the next essential steps on the road to just and sustainable food. You can find out more about the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm delighted to be here and to see so many friends and family and so many co-authors. One of the advantages of buying this book tonight, I'm not trying to sell anything, but there will never be more of the co-authors. There are six of us, and I think almost all of us are here tonight, so there's only two missing. So if you have any, you know, ideas that your book will be more valuable because these will be the only ones that many people have signed. So we'll all be signing after this is over. I'm very grateful to Kathy for the chance to use our book as a jumping off point for what is a very important conversation. We will ask just what is needed to achieve a just and sustainable food system in the Bay Area and beyond. And our panel is going to start by sharing their views on that topic, and then we will open it up for conversation with them and with you. And as I understand it, there are cards, and if you have a question, you can write it down, and then they'll be handed to me, and then I'll ask questions as we go along. Now, the book provides about 150 years of background for that conversation, but it focuses on a community of entrepreneurs, government officials, activists, and consumers that we now argue is pursuing a common agenda in the Bay Area for just and sustainable food. That community began to develop in the late 1960s, about the same time when the United Farm Workers were boycotting grapes, when Back to the Landers started to produce what was then called natural food. And those unconventional non-commodities morphed into California cuisine as Mr. Pete, the Cheese Board, and Chez Panisse anchored the development of Berkeley's gourmet ghetto. Celebrity chefs, which was sort of an odd concept at the time, proliferated and taught high-end consumers to demand beautiful, simple food. Farmers markets sprouted up all over the place, even while Black Panthers were feeding breakfast to Oakland school children on what must have seemed like a separate food planet altogether. So how all that has blended into what we're arguing is a shared agenda is a complex story. And what we've done, among other things, is to try to weave it together by chronicling how early understandings of food quality, which centered on aesthetics and flavor, became more demanding over time and the debate more inclusive. So what I'm going to do by way of introducing our panel is something kind of tricky. I'm going to try to present a quick summary of how we see those expectations for food quality in the process of telling you about our panel. So if you fall off, you'll just have to buy the book. These folks are all significant heroes in the story we tell. And I'll begin with Sue Conley, who was drawn into the struggling dairy economy of the West Marin Coast by Ellen Strauss of the Strauss Milk family. And Sue teamed up with Chez Panisse chef Peg Smith, and as the cowgirls, they envisioned an artisanal cheese district, which is sort of like a wine district, as a way to support family farmers and ranchers. Their work has taught consumers to enjoy fine cheese at the same time that it converts the Bay Area's fabulous organic milk into products that yield fair returns for local farmers and food processors and provide resources for paying fair wages to food system workers. The cowgirls were one of the first tenants in the Ferry Plaza food extravaganza, which is similarly in our story, a critical conduit for moving urban money to support alternative food and fair returns for food producers and food system workers. Next to Sue is Maisie Greenewalt, who is Vice President for Strategy at Bon Appetit Management Company. BAMCO is a food service firm that produces 135 million meals a year in university and corporate cafeterias. founded in San Francisco in 1987, just as environmental concerns were moving to the heart of our understanding of what constituted quality food, BAMCO defined its brand around sustainability. Bon Appetit has developed metrics for identifying sustainable practice and business systems that integrate small, sustainable producers into what is a fairly large-scale operation. But as the food got worse, relying more and more on chemical inputs, understanding of what constituted quality food broadened beyond sustainability to include human health issues. At first, that meant that well-heeled consumers could avoid many of the hormones and pesticides in conventional food by spending more money for organic, for example. But as data on diabetes and other diet-related diseases multiplied, starting in about the mid-1990s, new participants forced public health onto the agenda and redefined food quality yet again. Nikki Henderson is executive director of People's Grocery in Oakland, one of the organizations that has made food justice a central part of the shared food agenda in the Bay Area. Food justice emphasized access to all for healthy, nutritious food and self-determination and community self-development in the process of gaining that access. On Nikki's watch, concerns like school food, reintroducing cooking skills, and youth empowerment have become a part of the same shared, the part of the shared agenda of local advocates. And just to give you one data point on why we can argue that it's shared, I just point to Alice Waters pioneering Edible Schoolyard as one small indicator of that shared agenda. But expectations about justice as a component of food quality have also elaborated in the 21st century. Caleb Zigas is executive director of La Cocina, a Mission District-based program that provides assistance and affordable commercial kitchen space and technical support to small-scale entrepreneurs, largely immigrant women, who are developing food businesses, jobs, and an economic base in their own community. And in the absence of Caleb, who went to a wedding in New York last weekend and is somewhere with the books probably in LaGuardia, I have some information about La Cocina, which I'll make available because it's really a fantastic organization. One of the things that's most interesting is about La Cocina is that many of their clients, like the celebrity foragers and jam makers on the cover of our book, take as given principles for which previous alternative advocates fought. The new wave of food entrepreneurs values local, healthy, and organic, and it is pushing those values into very different markets, frequently in food carts and pop-ups. But La Cocina also uses Ferry Plaza in the same way that the Cowgirls and many others have done before them, to move capital from wealthier shoppers to their own neighborhoods. So I think it's absolutely clear in our book and tonight, I hope, that what our panelists have achieved and what our panelists have modeled for others is really impressive and important. But we are still not close to having a just and sustainable food system. So we have asked our panelists to start the conversation tonight by talking about how they see the next steps towards getting there and how we in the room can be involved and supportive. And Sue will start.
Thank you, Sally. Well, our part out in Point Reyes has been to help stabilize the rural economy there. And that wasn't an idea that we dreamed up. It was something that happened when we started working with Marin Agricultural Land Trust, which buys development rights from the farmers in exchange for the farmers agreeing not to divide and develop the land. And Alan Strauss started that organization about 30 years ago. And I met her 20 years ago, and she said, you know, we can be very successful with preserving this farmland in perpetuity, but unless we're producing things on it that bring a higher revenue to the ranchers. And unless they're beginning to have a little fun instead of just desperately trying not to go broke, we can't force people to farm this land. The miracle in Marin is that we've had the same families on the land for 150 years, and they actually want to stay there. They want to, they love what they do. And I think that, you know, we all work very hard making cheese and selling cheese, but no one works harder than the people milking the cows and taking care of the land. So I don't think we can say enough about that part of what we do, you know, that connection with those ranchers. We are city people. We didn't grow up on farms. But Peggy and I had great connections with the restaurant and specialty retail world. And I owned a restaurant in Berkeley called Betty's Ocean View Diner, and Peggy worked for Chez Panisse for 17 years. She was a chef in the kitchen. So we had those ethics of, you know, being very professional and very hardworking. And we thought that we could help kind of bring those products from Marin to the city markets. And that was a true uphill battle. When we started, there were 4 or 5 cheesemakers in Marin and Sonoma, and the dairies were going broke every year. Albert Strauss started the first organic dairy in the West, and today you can't talk to a rancher out there who's not either organic or transitioning to organic, and many of their kids have started to make cheese on the ranches. So today we have, what is it, Peggy, 27 cheesemakers, and they're making good cheese. This doesn't solve that problem of how people at Nikki's store can afford a $30 a pound cheese, but it has stabilized the farm economy out there, or we've been part of that effort, and it's something we're very proud of.
Well, at Bon Appetit, as Sally said, we serve 135 million meals a year. So I used to say that with great power comes great responsibility, and then I realized that I think I'm quoting Spider-Man when I say that, which I don't usually take my life direction from comic books. But I do believe that with great power comes responsibility, and that we have great power in many ways. One of those ways is that we buy literally hundreds of millions of dollars worth of food a year. Another is that we touch so many people through the meal that we serve them, and that we have 10,000 employees. And about 2004, our CEO and myself and our then director of culinary support and development were locked in a room talking about what direction we wanted to take the company. And we had done a lot of things that would now be called sustainability commitments, but at that time we didn't have those words. And we were talking about, do we go public with these? We've kind of kept these ideas secret. We didn't know how they fit into the for-profit model. We thought from the beginning that if we bought from small local farmers, that the food would taste better and that customers would taste the difference, therefore buy more of our food, therefore we could support the farmers. But we didn't know that people would care about the story. That sounds kind of crazy now, where everybody's clamoring to stick a picture of a farmer on their wall with a story, whether they're serving that farmer's product or not. But we didn't have that marketing genius behind us. We had a quest for flavor behind us. So in 2004, we were locked in this room trying to decide, do we put out a brochure? Do we, you know, how do we not greenwash while still telling the story? How do we get this balance? And I remember saying to our CEO, Fidel Baccio, everybody that we meet in this food world now has a story of, I was doing X, and then I ate at Chez Panisse, or I did a summer at Chez Panisse, or at Moosewood, and then I did Y. There was this transformative moment that happened related to those two restaurants, depending which coast you were on. And I said, what if we could do the same thing? What if people said, I was cooking one way, then I got a job at Bon Appetit Management Company, and now I cook differently. And that seemed crazy, that we could put ourselves in the league of these two really iconic bedrocks of the food movement. But I really believe now that a job with Bon Appetit, or being a Bon Appetit customer, if you're awake, and not everybody is, can be that pivotal experience for you. And that when we say to our chefs, you have to go out and find small farmers and make the connection yourself. And I got to tell you, there are a lot of farmers that wish we just signed you up at corporate and then gave you the chefs and said, here's the chefs to call and make it. But we say, no. You got to go out to that farmer's market, meet that farmer, make a connection, find out what they're growing, go to their farm. It's going to be a big pain. But if that is not the best part of your day, then you're with the wrong company. And ask a lot of questions, that we can create an engaged, sometimes a little overly righteous, I will say, consumer, both with Bon Appetit as the consumer and our customers as the consumer. And I think that is really, from a for-profit business's perspective, what our piece in the next level of the food movement will be. And I'd also like to add to that it's not just about the engagement we have with that small farmer, but at our scale, equally important is the engagement that we have with the large farmer, whether you want to call them a farmer or not, but that agribusiness producer, that if we pretend they're not there, they will continue to go on doing what they've been doing because they benefit from us all pretending they're not there. And we serve a lot of people. We're buying a lot of food. A lot of that is coming from small farmers. A lot of that isn't coming from small farmers. And so a big piece of what my job is figuring out how I can push those big producers, how they can make incremental change that is meaningful. What are their trigger points? Where can I raise a ruckus and where do I have to stroke to get them to make change? Because a small change at that big scale has huge impact as well. And they have that responsibility, and it's my job to remind them of it.
Good evening. I returned to the country yesterday, so if I am slightly incoherent, don't hold it against me. But when I think about what's next in the food movement, I think about the movement. Actually being next in the food movement. Because something that I've thought about, and having a background in energy efficiency and climate change, I was working in that before I came to the food movement. And energy is just, it felt really disciplined and really hardcore, just as a movement. You know, like climate change activists were just really intense. And then I come to the food movement and come to dinner. Let's build community. Don't you want to play in my garden? And it just, my first opinion of the food movement was that it was really undisciplined and that we would never make any wins because we didn't actually know how to be a movement. I have revised that opinion since actually interacting in the food movement, but I do feel like the next step is moving from this really beautiful relationship building place that we're in into actually being a sophisticated movement able to win legislative goals. And it's interesting because I feel like the story of People's Grocery is actually pretty reflective of that. Because 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, food justice wasn't a term. People's Grocery was one of the first organizations that actually called itself a food justice organization. And we started doing the direct service programs, the mobile market that everyone remembers with the loud speakers and the hip-hop music and the youth in bright T-shirts selling the food and our farms. And it was tangible, it was easy to understand, and it was inspiring. And now 10 years later, we've spun off a grocery store called People's Community Market that's a separate for-profit entity and a $3.6 million project. Our GrubBox program has become this partnership between a farm and us where we each take different parts of the operation so that it can actually function in a nonprofit context. We do this really intense emotional intelligence, historical systems of oppression and structural racism work called allyship. The work that we do is, it's a lot more complicated now than a garden. It's harder to understand. But I also feel like it's the work that's required to jump from we run a cool garden and have a youth program to we're preparing activists to take on extraordinarily complex conversations in a way that will change the hearts and minds of large groups of people that will then move the entire system. And so the story that I'm really curious about is that journey for the food movement. From February in 2009, when Michelle Obama planted the White House garden, to now, all of the resources that have been poured into this movement that most Americans think is new, I think, because they just didn't really think about it before, now we have converted millions of people. And what are we doing with them? That's my question. What are we doing with them? I know what they're doing with them. But what are we doing with them? Because they're a part of us. And as long as we stay in the original food movement, which are folks like me that kind of, well, I'm a convert. Truth, I'm a convert. I am one of those millions of people that quit my energy efficiency job after she planted the White House garden and defected over into the food movement. And there's a lot of us. There's a lot of us ex-environmental movement, ex-energy folks that are hiding out in the food movement who are now completely down. But I wonder, like, the spectrum of people that were the original, I had that organic garden 20 years ago, to the brand new spectrum of, I read Omnivore's Dilemma a week ago, and I've changed my eating habits, and tell me, what do I do? I want a produce box and a garden. Help me. And all of that are people that we need to activate. So the next step for me is, how?
Kathy, are you going to bring us cards, or how do you want us to proceed now? We have lots of... Okay, thank you.
You can ask your own, and we'll intermingle questions from the audience.
Okay.
Lots of questions.
Well, one of the questions that I had was about the relationship. So, Nikki, you were addressing this directly. So, why don't we start with you and then see what that brings up for you too, about the role of trying to change and reform the dominant system on the one hand, as opposed to creating an alternative system on the other hand, and how those two projects might play out to answer your question.
Okay. And now my brain says this is being recorded. So an interesting story with People's Grocery is that when I first got there, People's Grocery, we were a justice organization, right? There were people we didn't take money from, and our salaries were low because of it. And we had integrity, you know, like just integrity. That was our salary, was our integrity. And now that we're sophisticating a bit, it's a little more hazy. You know, integrity is really easy to find when you don't have a lot of responsibility. I feel like that's the new thing in my head. And this either-or question has come up quite a bit of, are we reformists or are we revolutionary? And I feel like when I was doing sustainability work in my graduate program, I had a professor who really tried to bang into our heads the fact that ideologies are great, but what you really need to start with is, if you're trying to feed a bunch of people, and you could feed all of them if you took water from another place and brought it here, what's the cost-benefit ratio of just using what you have in this area or carting water in? Like, there's indicators across the spectrum. And there is no perfect equation of if you do these five things on this land. I'm not making sense. But it's a series of dynamics that you just have to take into account. And there will be factors to consider in all of those dynamics. So at People's Grocery, for example, when it comes to who we take money from and whether an activity or an initiative we do is truly justice or whether it's a band-aid on the current system that's screwing over a bunch of people, the complication with the band-aid is that those 20 kids that actually helps, even though they're participating in the dominant system, maybe won't die. And that's actually worth it for me. And on the other hand, the revolutionary acts aren't reinforcing a system that might kill 100 more kids in 20 years. So where your heart and your integrity lies is the answer to that question for me. And it gets complicated when that answer is different for everyone on staff. So you just have to make educated, informed decisions. And I feel like that's actually part of leadership, is weighing all those factors.
Weigh in on that one?
One of the areas that I'm really passionate about in my food movement is around farm workers' rights. And about 4 years ago, we had a moment where we said, we're going to start asking some tough questions. We've been asking some questions of each other and not coming up with answers around farm workers, sitting in the office wondering what we could do. We're going to move out of the inaction to action. And we hired three really smart young people and put together a farm labor survey and sent them out to talk to our suppliers. And they went to our farm-to-fork suppliers, who they know, and they talked to many, many farmers. They did many, many farm visits, and they found tens of farm workers. Where are farm workers? The majority of farm workers are on really big mechanized farms. If we don't address that dominant system, I don't think we can address one of the biggest ills of our current food system, and that is how we do our labor, who's picking our food. My work on this issue also took me to a farm in Mexico, and I would have sat here a year ago and said we should not be bringing produce in from Mexico, and we should be supporting small farmers as much as possible and trying to not have multinationals growing our food. And then I went to this farm in Mexico, and I saw schools and healthcare facilities and apartments where families could live together that had kitchens in them. And I'm not saying that you or I probably want to live there, but compared to what I have seen farm workers living in our country, that they had to come across a border and pay a lot of money to illegally come to live in literally a hut, I thought, am I really going to be that, again, I come to that word righteous, to sit here and say that our system should be so insular, that what this grower is doing in Mexico is not right. And we made a decision. It's been hard to implement. It's a decision, still a work in progress, that we were going to get all of our berries in California in the winter months from this one grower in Mexico that is doing things so differently, because I think there should be market reward for doing something so differently. But to get to the question again, I think for certain issues, we have to deal with the dominant system. We can't just marginalize ourselves by only dealing with the alternative system.
Let me just take a break. Thank you.
Yeah,
I want to clap for that. I just want to remind you folks that you are listening to a Commonwealth Club program, California Cuisine and Just Food. I'm Sally Fairfax, and we're talking with Sue Conley, Maisie Greenewalt, and Nikki Henderson. Well, since I threw Nikki that curve about the dominant and the alternative system, this is not my question. You can't blame me for this. This is a wonderful question from the audience about the relationship between the environmental movement and the just food movement, and why our questioner wants comments on, and we can all think about this. Why do you think the two movements are so different and they're separate? Why aren't they the same thing?
Well, this is definitely something that needs to change, and it's very true that the environmental movement of the past has been a white, upper-class, righteous movement, and there are efforts to, especially, what's that group in Vermont called? Anyway, it's very important to change that dynamic. In Marin, environmentalists and agriculturalists have worked together. There are still conflicts. We have a conflict with our oyster company in Drake's Bay, where environmentalists want them out and the agriculturalists are very protective because we need all of the infrastructure and support for agriculturalists throughout the Point Reyes area. So Marin is an example of those two groups working together. But the environment is for everyone. It's not just for upper-class white people. And so I'm not sure we've made inroads there, but we have, for instance, a vote in Marin for open space and agriculture Measure A, and you can't get 2/3 majority for a tax measure unless everyone is in on the cause. So we'll see what happens there. I think that's all I have to say.
There are several questions here about Prop 37, and one was said, I think we can all answer this one. I don't know if we should can discuss it, but how do we vote on the GM labeling proposition? Does anybody want to answer that? I think
we vote for labeling, yes. Of course. That's easy.
Does anybody out there want to say anything about that? Okay.
Yes on 37.
Yes on 37. Yeah, I don't think that's a hard one.
This is not the counter argument. But I got into an argument with a dairyman, not one of your suppliers, I promise you, who was very adamant about the RBGH labeling. And I think as a business person, I say to any business person, including those that are against 37, that you never, ever win in business or in life by not telling people the truth. You cannot have your business model be based on not informing your consumer about your product. So there are many, many reasons that we are all on this side, and that I think is an important one.
This is an interesting question for all of us, I think. How do you see the buying power of California's low-income shoppers driving a healthy and just food system? I know if you go on... is it your website? I think if you go on People's Grocery website or Community Market, what is it, 58 million? People in Oakland. People in West Oakland spend $58 million a year on food. So the question is, how do you see the buying power of low-income shoppers driving a healthy and just food system?
Well, the second part of that statistic is it's, I think 70% of that $58 million is spent outside of West Oakland. So there, the market for food in West Oakland, if you brought some of the food retail to West Oakland, is tremendous. And I think, at least with the current climate, the spending power of low-income people is not enough to bring traditional grocery stores to the community. And I don't know about other types of food retail, but at least with supermarkets and grocery stores, a lot of the research that Brahm Amati was the co-founder of People's Grocery, and he's now the CEO of People's Community Market. Years ago, when he was the executive director, he did research to try to figure out really what were the reasons why grocery stores left low-income communities. And really, it seemed to boil down to the fact that margins were so low in grocery stores, between 3 and 5%, that anything, even 1 or 2% increase on that, if they moved to a different neighborhood, was enough to make them leave. And so I think as long as margins are that low, there isn't going to be a lot of incentive for grocery stores with mainstream business models to relocate into inner city communities. And that's why socially responsible food retail folk are the ones that are really trying to start grocery stores in low-income communities. But then there's also the fact that the last thing I'll say about this is there was an article. There's been several articles over the last couple of years about how food deserts don't actually exist, because the studies that have been done across the country where they map the just physical location distance of different inner city communities to grocery stores is equivalent to affluent communities. And the conversation, when it's simplified like that, it makes it seem like people in inner city communities just don't buy healthy food, right? It's not that there's no grocery stores. It's just that we don't really want to eat healthy. And truth is that food access is a combination of location and appropriateness and affordability. And when I say appropriateness, it's also that inner city communities tend to be ethnic communities. And so if you're not selling the kinds of things that people eat, they're probably not going to buy them or even recognize half the time. So that market, that's a whole other conversation when it comes to the food pyramid or my plate not actually applying to a lot of Americans when it comes to the way that we eat. And I think until those kind of complexities are incorporated into the conversation about market share when it comes to food retail, the buying power in low-income communities is not going to really be a factor, which is where the movement comes in.
I think, though, the other area is the institutional food. Mm-hmm. What you do is so important to farmers. Also, hospital and school meals can really help the agriculturalists.
Well, that I it seems to me that one of the elements that I find kind of, when I hear it mentioned, it sort of sounds like a cop-out. But which is odd given how I spent my life, but I really think that an important element of the movement is education. And it's not educating people about what good food is by not feeding them toxic slop in public school lunches. And the effort that many, many communities are making to improve the food that's offered in school meals, it seems to me, is among the most important elements of building not only a movement but also a healthier population. So whereas I always think when somebody calls for education, it's kind of, you know, it's not sufficiently authentic or revolutionary, it seems to me that that's probably where this has to at least, not if not start, at least invest an enormous amount of effort. We are coming up on a point of where we want to open this up and hear from you, not on cards, but chatting. So I'll just ask one more question from the floor, and then I hope we can start to have a more general conversation. These questions are excellent. I certainly am glad that they don't use this system at Cal. So here's one for you guys to play with, and you guys can think about it too, and maybe that's how we'll start talking together. If you had unlimited funds, there's several that are sort of like this. It's sort of the magic wand question. If you could do one thing, you had unlimited funds and a goal of providing healthy food to underserved populations, where would you start? What would you do? What would be the first thing you would do if there was, you know, unlimited funds and you could do what you wanted? Is that a good way to get at sort of what has to happen next?
That is a really hard question.
Rob.
I think the point that you just made about children and health and food, I mean, I started with Francis Moore LePay at a Michigan network, and I've been following this for a long, long time. In Sonoma County, the Santa Rosa City Schools built a whole new kitchen because they wanted to cook food. They wanted to prepare food. Most of the food in Sonoma County in schools is shipped in from Chicago, it's frozen and it's heated up, they have no kitchens. And the Santa Rosa school system has invited and gotten support of Alvarado Street Bakery. They provide all the bread that's served to the children of those school systems. And they are buying locally as best they can, although it's difficult for them. But they basically have an organic menu only for the elementary school system. And I think it's this issue of health. The Michelle Obama Garden is the most, I think, potentially driving mechanism. The health, the cost of health, and the Sonoma County Health Department has really worked hard on this as well, to work with farms to fork or farms the table and the schools and that sort of thing. But, you know, you talk about the movement, it's health and it's justice, and justice is health. And food is one of the first things that you have to look at. And it follows all the way back. The whole issue about GMO is not just about what's in that food, but what that all those organisms do in all the soil. So I think that food is the justice. And health is the most driving force of it. All the people who are buying organic that worked before, that were brought up on regular food, are young mothers. That is the driving force, I think, of a lot of the organic. So schools first.
We have a lady that's bouncing up and down in her seat. Please.
The thing I like about that question is that it requires you to sort of think outside the box completely and not be limited by the way we normally think. And so, to me, I go to that the issue of availability and relevance of the food. So, I was wondering if the panel could comment on the idea of assuming that you have unlimited funds and you can grow food and bring it into underserved communities and set up, say, farm stands or some kind of pop-up type of, you know, they have pop-up studios now. So pop-up grocery stores that supply healthy food for almost nothing, because again, we're assuming unlimited funds in these communities. I mean, how would something like that actually work? I mean, would it work? Or what do you think?
Well, I know that, you know, one problem is that we have a lot of young farmers now. There's actually a lot of energy in the, like, 20 to 30 age bracket, people wanting to farm, and there's not land for them, there's not resources to teach them how to be successful. And I think if you had a lot of funds to get them going, they could figure out how to get it into the city in an affordable way. And then you guys can take it from there.
Well, it's very similar to what you're saying. I don't have an unlimited budget or a magic wand, but I do have some money that I get to give away every year. And what I decided to do with it this year is to give it to ALBA. Are you familiar with ALBA in Salinas? It's a fantastic model that's a lot about what Sue's describing, where they teach it is, I don't know, 90-some-odd percent Latino, essentially teaching farm workers to become organic farmers, and then they incubate them by giving them land to farm. And you see these people who are now controlling their own destiny as farm owners, that are doing better by the land, that are then going to be able to bring this food to their families and to their communities, growing the things that are more relevant to them because they have the power now. That is, if I had unlimited funds, I would put a lot of albas out there in a lot of different communities in different forms.
And, just really quickly, if I had a magic wand, I would need a lot of money, just clear, billions of dollars. And I would spend it on redesigning the way that we value food monetarily. Because I think whenever I just backtrack, the food system was built on importing labor from another continent. You know, like, we have actually never, since the founding of this country, valued food monetarily at what it actually costs for hundreds of years. So we actually need to redesign the entire food system from scratch, I feel like. And then I wonder if we did that, actually could value monetarily food the way that it should be. A lot of these other issues, kind of the way that it trickles down, would shift, because the way that resources flow then in the system would actually completely change. So that would be my really big, long-term, billions of dollars.
Yes?
Our family has had many foster children with us for years, and we used to buy at Costco at a time when they were not organic. And because we live in Vermont now, Costco stores are carrying organic, this organic meat, vegetables. And I'm wondering what can be done for other communities. We have a population that demands it, but what can be done in this movement to affect Costco's and other areas and stores like that?
Well, this is where I feel like, you know, sort of like a weenie when I say it really is important to educate people about what constitutes food. And there are a lot of problems with that. You know, if you look back at the history of do-gooder white ladies like myself trying to tell people what food is, the history is fairly bleak. For example, there was a whole movement in New York around the turn of the century that was trying to tell immigrants that it was not safe to cook everything in one pot. So Hungarians were told, for example, not to eat goulash, and large numbers of people were told not to cook everything in one pot because this was regarded as not really food. So it's a very short step from telling people that what they're eating isn't food to some kind of oppressive. Well, there's a wonderful book called Nature's Perfect Food by Melanie Dupuy, and it's about how milk became the sine qua non of healthy children around the turn of the century as milk started to get pasteurized and get healthy. And the problem with that is that large classes of people are and remain lactose intolerant, and it wasn't a perfect food for them. So this was just a very clear-cut example of how what I think is absolutely food may not be, and that the history of trying to upgrade people's tastes by telling them to be reasonable, do it my way, is rather grim. So I don't know how you get around that problem, but for me the most important thing is to stop miseducating people by serving Hot Pockets in kindergarten. I can't see way in the back.
Well, going off of your education and talking.
Can you stand up? I can't hear you, maybe.
Going off of the discussion on education and Hot Pockets for kindergartners, I think, you know, I've been reading a lot about bringing home ec back to high schools, and I think that's where you really need to start with education, is when, you know, kids are old enough to still have an open mind about things, but be smart enough and be able to educate themselves about what they're eating and what they're making. And, you know, in high school it's all about convenience and going home and just heating up a hot pocket when your mom's not home and you're making something. And so teaching kids how to, you know, go home and make a healthy snack for themselves, I think, is really important. You know, I cook a lot and I have friends over a lot for dinner, and they have no idea, you know, how to make just a simple healthy meal for themselves, and they just think I make the most gourmet meals, but it's really like, you know, I'm just making normal proportionate meals with, you know, a carbohydrate and a vegetable and, you know, whatever. But I think it's really about educating them at, you know, a young enough age where they're open to learning about it.
Yeah.
I do a lot of reading, so I don't know where I got the information. But there are some very successful programs where they grow food in elementary schools.
Mm-hmm.
And these kids know what food is about. They know where carrots come from, etc. And those kids grow up to be adults that know what good food is. And it's, I think it's that simple. All these other things you're doing, if you start with young kids and let them plant the seeds and watch the seeds germinate, water the plants, pick the fruit, and then prepare the food, you've changed the whole course of the culture. You're not doing that. You're not teaching children how to grow food and what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
You're treating the what they call it, symptom instead of the problem.
I have a question about getting back to the alternate versus dominant systems. In this state, I think with the Central Valley being, in general, part of the dominant system, and in the Bay Area, maybe potentially being part of the alternative system, what's that relationship within the state between those geographic areas, and how does the Bay Area engage the Central Valley as we think about changing the food system?
Well, in the dairy industry, you know, there's been a lot of consolidation, and the Central Valley has the very large dairies. It's not working. You know, they keep buying another cow, another cow, another cow, and then the price of milk goes down, and they have to get another cow, and it never adds up. In our area, you know, we're not consolidating. It's a, you know, series of smaller farms that are unique. So that's worked in our area. We'll see if there's consolidation in our area. I mean, that's the dominant. The co-op is now a national co-op. All dairy co-ops used to be local. Now, the conventional dairies are driving to Modesto to deliver their milk. And that's happening all over the country. I just don't think it's a workable system. You know, I think it will eventually go back to more local control if we can hang on to the land long enough, you know, that it's not developed for other reasons. But I think that we've established enough of a strength in our area that we won't have that.
We have time for one more question.
Are y'all seeing any changes in urban food production and consumption?
You mean urban farms?
Yes, or gardens.
Are you seeing that?
Change.
When you say change, what do you mean?
Growth in proportion of food produced and consumed from urban gardens, urban school gardens or community gardens.
Yeah.
Gardens.
Well, certainly, 4 years ago, there were much, much fewer gardens in the city than there are now. And I think one of the questions that I wrestle with is urban gardens and what they can supply for the actual food needs of an urban community is such a small isn't even the word, you know, like it's a slice, a little itty bitty slice. And so, sure, you know, there's more, but what is the function of urban farming really? And that's actually been a big question over the last year. PolicyLink did this big urban farming study across the country to actually check that question out and see, is the goal of urban farming to feed people, or is the goal of urban farming something else? The something else being, there were times in American history where kitchen gardens were actually supplying a very large part of people's diets. And so scale-wise, what will it take for gardening to actually make a dent in food consumption and the way that Americans eat? So urban farms as education and urban farms as a tool to activate communities around food have been incredibly successful. And I think that that's actually, for me, one of the big goals of them. And in that sense, they've been very successful.
Well, we are out of time. And I would like to thank Sue and Maisie and Nikki, and I would like to thank our audience. And Kathy looks like she has something she wants to say.